So the main lesson learned is that roofscapes really make a neighborhood look like a neighborhood. Most of the credit on this goes to John Regan architects, but the variety and diversity of roof pitches, roof colors, roof forms tied to the styles of the buildings really makes this look like an actual neighborhood. You can see this project from the interstate, which comes through town, and it just looks like a neighborhood as opposed to all those hundreds of little red tile roofs lined up all the same way, which you see in most cases. And you can make you can get merchant builders to make real public space. And the communication tool that has been invaluable to us is the form-based code. So I will now fire up Chad's presentation, and he will talk about what he's doing to help municipalities use codes like this. There you go. Like this.
Does this work?
Can you hear me? Raise your hand if you can't hear me. Okay. Somehow we jumped ahead a little here. All right. Montgomery, Alabama. Who's ever been to Montgomery, Alabama? Anybody? Okay, got a few of y'all. Montgomery, Alabama is the most historic city that you probably didn't realize was historic. It's really interesting. I like to go around the country and find cities which used to be prominent, very prominent, which are no longer really that prominent. A great example is Buffalo, New York. Anyone been to Buffalo before? Buffalo used to be a very prominent city turn of the century. And you go there and look at some of their schools in particular in Buffalo. Wow. I mean, just amazing civic buildings. The money and some of the great original skyscrapers that Sullivan did and stuff like that. But it's no longer prominent. And what Montgomery kind of falls in that class is that Montgomery was once a very prominent city. It was the birth, they pitch it as the chamber or CVB or whatever, pitches it as the birthplace of the civil rights and the Civil War. The telegram or the teletype or whatever to start the Civil War was sent from a building, actually where we held the downtown charrette, was sent from that building to start the Civil War. And the Selma to Montgomery March occurred here. So there's a lot of history tied up into Montgomery, but what happens, it suffered more than just about anywhere in terms of urban renewal. So you had a lot of people who their grandparents were still around that still remembered the greatness of Montgomery, but its greatness had long since passed. In fact, it had really died on the vine. So one of the strategies is, well, let's try to recreate Montgomery, restore it with a modern twist. And so we've gone through a series of different coding efforts. Coding is really important because there are a lot of wonderful plans, probably drawn by some of you in this very room and many of us who are attending this event, that are sitting on shelves gathering dust. The plans are great, but the code was never put in place to implement it. The regulation. Ultimately, you have to have that regulatory piece which makes it law. Otherwise, it's just a vision. You can have a great vision, but you can't implement that vision because you don't have the laws to allow you to do it. Well, that's all it is. It's a really nice book which people look at, but they don't actually have to follow. So what we wanted to try to do is get the law in place that would implement the vision. Syncing up the vision with the tools. A great example, we have a five-year-old and a three-year-old. And they're at the point where they just got them bunk beds. You know, that stage where you get them bunk beds, the two boys. And so we went over to IKEA in Atlanta. There's a new IKEA. Anyone ever been to IKEA before? Well, IKEA is nice. It's kind of like the Swedish Walmart. Everything's cheap, but actually fairly well designed. And so we went there and brought back the IKEA. Well, it's cheap because why? Because it comes in like 25,000 pieces. Okay, so we bought the bunk bed and bring it home, and it's like in a box this wide. It's amazing what how they package those things. And we open it up, and there's the blueprint for putting this bed together. And I looked and I said, I can't believe this. I should have paid the $100 to have someone do this. Well, my 5-year-old Owen comes in, and he's at that age where he says, you know, Daddy, can I help you? You know that age? And so I said, okay, well, Daddy's going to need the tools. So he goes and gets a hammer. He goes and runs downstairs, asks my wife, says, I need a hammer. And because he figured that's what a tool is. So I bring it up there. I guess I could have hammered those screws into that wood and it might have, you know, stood briefly. Anything wrong with the hammer? No, it was just the wrong tool for that vision, the blueprint. So I said, Owen, Daddy doesn't need a hammer, I need a screwdriver. So I ran downstairs again, asked my wife, brought up a Phillips head screwdriver, just the right screwdriver. But the problem is, like I said, there were 25,000 screws to be screwed. And a manual Phillips head screwdriver was not going to finish the job this millennia. So I said, Owen, that's the right screwdriver, but I need what? I need the power tool. Okay, I need the power screwdriver. Go tell Mommy. And so comes up, brings the power screwdriver, and guess what? I had the most efficient tool to implement the vision, the blueprint. And that's the key. Not just to find a tool that works. I could have hammered those things in there. I could have manually, but find the most efficient tool that implements the vision most efficiently. And that's what we're trying to do in Montgomery. We chose to use the form-based, transect-based smart code, which is just a branded code. It's a well-known brand, but there's a lot of ways you can create a transect-based or form-based code. I don't want you to think that the smart code is some kind of idea on high. It's just a brand of a form-based, transect-based code, the one we chose to use. This is an image from the Dover Coal Charette. Before we get started, let's talk about a little bit of Montgomery as a significant history. Interesting picture, right? If you've been to Montgomery recently, that's Dexter Avenue. At the top is the Capitol on something called Goat Hill. You wouldn't see this many people in Montgomery for any reason. And the downtown. I mean, there aren't that many people living in the downtown that you could compile them like that. But that was in the late 1800s. Then Montgomery became electrified in a major way, obviously. It was actually one of the first it was the first electric trolley in North America was in Montgomery. And Alabama Power made lots of money with all of these wires. But again, you saw a streetscape, which looks, if you can look through the wires, fairly interesting. Okay. Here's an image. Montgomery is actually two towns. I can't see the screen. So on your left is one of the first towns, and you see two actual grids which came together. One was addressing the rail, one was addressing the river, and the two cities just kind of merged. And you see some of the historical examples. A brief chronology, though, knowing that you have this, which was some great things that happened in Montgomery, but some very just urban renewal has blighted it. I should have showed some more slides of just how the Embassy Suites Hotel came in. It's just like the Embassy Suites that you find at an interchange in the interstate. Blew out half this incredible block. So they had this huge parking lot in front. And so some very bad things happen, which this is an interesting lesson learned. If you're in really bad shape, things are a lot easier. I mean, when you can look at the city councilors or the planning commission and say, this place is terrible. This place is bombed out. I mean, what you've been doing for the last 10, 15, 20, 25 years, look what's happened. That's a pretty compelling argument. You say, let's at least try something else, okay? The Tylenol's not working. Let's try Advil. Let's do something else for this headache which we've created. So a brief chronology. In January of 2006, we adopted an optional smart code. What do you mean by optional? Well, it means that anyone live in a jurisdiction with a PUD ordinance, a PUD. Okay, a PUD is generally unmapped. Okay, the developers say, I would like to use the PUD. And they'll go to the planning office and say, I would like to elect to use this option. Okay, and then they create the standards for that option. The optional smart code worked a lot of that way. It wasn't mapped anywhere in the city zoning map until a developer said, I have a sufficient number of contiguous acres to create a complete community. I think it's 40 acres or whatever that they came up with. And I therefore elect to have my land rezoned from R1 or Ag or whatever it was to the Smart Code District. The first developer that did this in Montgomery was a developer, Louder New Homes. Some of you may have heard. It's actually the Colonial Company. It's a private company, but one of the largest developers in Alabama and a large developer in the Southeast in general. And that was really helpful because a lot of times you find T&Ds to be the entrepreneurial types, but a lot of times the big developers don't come in until the other developers have taken the risk. Well, we got lucky. The big developer wanted to come in, partly because, and I don't see him in the room, they came up with me. Anna Louder and her husband Harvey Sahota are here if you get a chance to meet them. They're the actual developers of this project. We adopted this optional smart code in January of 2006 so that we could permit this project, a DPZ design project called Hampstead. Go to townofhampstead.com if you want to see more of it. The charrette was, I think, in August of 2005. And we realized we could use a PUD for this, but the PUD process in Montgomery was just a mess. We said, you know, let's be the first greenfield T&D in the United States of America to be permitted under an existing smart code. That's what this was, the very first one. The smart code had been used as a private code to regulate the project. This is the very first one in the United States of America under an existing smart code. And some of the benefits, in fact, I won't even go reiterate them because Dave did a great job. You saw a lot of the form benefits. A lot of those things were illegal, though. Under existing Euclidean codes, most of what we're trying to do is illegal or not by right. The mixture of uses, the setbacks, the streets, all these kind of things. They're all something you have to just go through this incredible negotiation process through variances and things like that to get. The PUD allows you to do it, but it doesn't require it. What the smart code and form-based codes do this. They take the PUD concept of getting away from those strict Euclidean land use first ideas and makes them not just an option, because some PUDs have been used to create some of the worst urbanism you'll see anywhere, in Montgomery included. The Lifestyle Center, whatever that means, was created under a PUD, okay? And people said, well, we have to use a PUD because PUD allows you to create this Lifestyle Center, as if we want to replicate that. But the result was that the smart code and other form-based codes don't just allow you to create something, it actually requires you to create the goodness, okay? And so the developer can't come in and say, okay, well, you know what, I like this mixture of use thing, and I also want the 100-foot right-of-way with 14-foot travel lanes. No, it's you have the whole package which fits together, or you don't get the package, you don't get the benefit. So we adopted it in January 2006. Really interesting thing here in Montgomery. Nothing passes unanimously except for this. This passed 9-0, 8-0 on the Planning Commission. There was one person not there. And 9-0 in City Council. The reason was this, because we could look every developer in the eye and say, and every landowner in the eye and say, we're not taking away a single land right. We're only adding to your options. Now, I'll be the first to admit that an optional smart code or option forward-based code should not be your final destination. That should not be the goal of where you're going to. But we adopted a very incremental strategy. Let's get our foot in the door so that if someone wants to do the right thing and do it legally, they don't have to govern by variance or try to figure out a PUD negotiation. They can have the good standards by right. Okay? So we got our foot in the door with the optional smart code. First smart code application then came along, that was Hampstead. This is what it looked like. This was just one page. It's about a 16-page document they submitted. Okay? I don't know how easy it is to see up there. But it's a very regulatory-based document. Okay? Took quite a while to prepare, but it has the graphics, it has the calculations. And the planning staff loved it because it was both illustrative as well as actual regulatory in its nature. And you could look. Now, the hard part is they're trying to figure out what do all these numbers and circles and colors mean. And we'll talk about that in just a second. But once they've gotten familiar with, okay, you know, what is it? Was T3 135.2%? What does that mean? That's Greek to a lot of them, but now they're starting to learn the language. It's making a lot of sense. So the first application, again, August 2005, the charrette for Hampstead. The code gets passed in January of 2005. The application is submitted and approved in June of 2006. And so now the optional code is being used. It's in place. We have a pilot project going. Well, we anticipated the next increment would probably be somewhere 2007, 2008. We'd then try to make a mandatory downtown smart code. Well, the people loved Hampstead. And to give the Colonial Company credit, it was a private project, but they really made it a public charrette for all intents and purposes. A lot of times you get the private charrettes, they don't want the competition to see it, but their competition came in, everyone, and people had an opening presentation, a closing, a public pinup during a private charrette. I mean, that's not very common for a private T&D, but they did that because they thought it was a good marketing tool to do, and people loved it in Montgomery. So much so, they're like, well, let's make this Hampstead like what you have to do downtown. And we said, okay, that's fine. That's a good vision. We can do that vision. We can hire somebody to do that vision, but we don't have the tools to implement that vision. So before we do that, we have to get the tools in place. We don't want to spend a nice bit of money on a downtown vision without the tools in place. And so we are able to convince the planning office to pay for Dover Coal to come in. It's a picture of some of us walking around. They're all just, you can just see them all looking up in the skies thinking, yeah, this is going to be a tough job. We had some sit-down charrettes over at Alabama State. Got the public involved. Victor at the opening presentation. There is one remaining good building in downtown Montgomery. We've been able to use it for the opening presentation. And this is just one of the results. This is one of the visions which people created. And this is a wonderful process. This is nothing what Montgomery looks like now. It's what it once looked like. And it's what it can look like again. But to do that, we told them that we have to pass the code which allows this. You'll see things like the gallery there, the on-street parking, a lot of those different, and the mixture of uses, obviously, would be illegal under Montgomery's existing code. So they passed the downtown smart code, mandatory downtown smart code, adopted just this month. Again, the Planning Commission and the City Council, get this, unanimous both times again. There have been 35 people voting on the smart code in Montgomery. 35 separate votes between the Planning Commission, and there's been 35 yeses, not a single no. You've got to understand, this is kind of a big deal. Because what this does, what the smart code of downtown Montgomery, here's the transect map, that's the new zoning map for downtown Montgomery. All of the B1, all of the O1, all of the B1A, B5-6s, they're all gone. We've killed them, we buried them and sent them away, and we've replaced them with transect-based zones. Okay, so now if you are living in, or if you're a property owner downtown Montgomery, what you do is you go down to City Hall, you look on the map, find what your piece of land, what color it is, go to the legend, say what the zone is, and look in the zoning code, and there have it. Now we had to add a subzone. We have T4 reserved and T4 open, because basically we wanted on some of the main corners to have a minimum two stories. And just to keep, I'm not a designer, but there's apparently a good reason for doing that. So that's the downtown zoning map for Montgomery. And that's mandatory. It's not an option. Our incremental strategy worked. It actually accelerated. It accelerated so bad that we ran into a problem. Guess what the problem was? Is we got this adopted before the staff and everyone in the development community was ready to do it in the sense of the bandwidth. They were still operating on the existing code. We didn't have the opportunity to educate them enough. So we ran across this problem is that the City Council and the Planning Commission said, oh, this is a great idea. We could have told them to adopt whatever they wanted. They liked the vision so much. And I mean, it was picking the low fruit then. Okay. So we had to come up with post-adoption issues. Yeah, you ever get there and you get something done, you're like, okay, what do I do next? The excitement of the charrette wears off. All the great, Steve Price did some great urban advantage images, these computer generation, all these just wonderful things, and you're like, now we got to do it. Okay. And so we decided that we're going to spend most of our effort and time, we're going to hold off on doing other mandatory areas, and we're going to teach people how to use a form-based code, how to administer it. Because, again, even if you have the tool in place, you don't know how to use it or fully use it, it's still not that effective a tool. Case in point, my wife's a photographer, and she uses Photoshop and some other Photoshop, that's supposedly a powerful piece of software. Or when I see some of these planners and designers using InDesign or something like that, that is a powerful piece of software. You know what I can do with Photoshop? Upload the photos. I might be able to crop them. Okay, I might figure out how to do that. But that's a tool that I don't know how to use. Does that mean it's a bad tool? No, it means that I am a bad user. I haven't learned. I haven't tapped the power. Whereas my wife, she'll go up there and put these collages, and they're tinted and all this kind of stuff. And I'm like, how to do that? Okay, it's because she knows how to fully maximize the power of the tool. And we entered into a unique problem. We had this powerful tool, this transect-based, form-based code, the smart code, that the staff and the developers didn't know how to fully untap the power. They were just like, we can upload it and crop it. So we had to just figure out how we were going to teach them.
So here's some key post-adoption issues, some practical things that I hope will help you. Again, this is advice for if you've adopted the form-based code and it's in place. This advice is intended to streamline, to make your life easier, the staff's life and the community. And the first thing we did is staff and community training. The staff needs to be trained because they're going to be the one reviewing the applications as they get submitted, right? But the community, and not just the developers, but the community, you need to keep them engaged. So as you're doing training, we'd still invite the auxiliary groups. We were very cautious not to make it look like there's any sleight of hand going on, that there's any inside baseball being played. So we had a training session. We would invite the president of all the neighborhood associations. You can't invite everyone. I mean, at some point it becomes impractical. So we would have the witnesses there that nothing squirrely is going on. They could report back to their communities, yeah, this is not some backroom deal. This is real. Okay, so the staff and community training, types of training. Two types of training which are really important. The application preparation. We needed to train the developers and the landowners how to prepare an application, that document I showed you. How do you prepare that for submission? They said, yeah, this smart code's great, and we know it's a new way of doing things, but what information do we have to give you, city, in order to get the appropriate permits? So we went through a series of application preparations. We met with the developers and the realtors and the builders, and we would just walk them through the applications. The good thing is it's optional again. It paid off, this strategy again, because we had an application on file, the Hampstead Article 3 application. It was essentially the development plan stage or the site plan stage. And we had it. We could say, let's thumb through this. You don't have to, this is not a template you have to use, but this is one that's been approved. So guess what? Just put the information that's in here in yours, and if it meets the code, it gets approved. So we were training the developers. And that, the challenge there is this. If you're a developer, you've got a lot more things to do than sit around and learn how to prepare an application. And you've got a lot of demands on your time. That was the challenge with the staff. The staff, we could have spent days at a time. Okay. So we had to figure out very efficient ways. Okay. One thing that was a big thing is we removed all food. There were no lunches or breakfast or things like that. We just come in and say, hey, give us an hour, and we'll just, you know, a boot camp type mentality where we'll walk through these. A lot of images. Real good advice that David said is try not to use all these historical images from like the 1800s because they're going to be like, huh? They didn't have plumbing back then. What is that relevant to us? Okay, they didn't have electricity going in the house. They didn't have natural gas. Try to use more modern images. Because they can say, oh, that was built 5 years ago. Okay, that's relevant to me, building right now. Then the application review. We had to train the staff. Okay, you get this document in. How do you know if it's compliant with the code? How do you review these applications? Montgomery chose not to have a standardized template. They may in the future, but right now they chose to have an approach where it was each developer could submit it and they had to identify the information in there, but they didn't create that template yet. But the staff comes in, they look at this 16-page document, they're like, well, where does this provision show that it's being complied with? So we had to train the staff. Okay. Part of this was defining the review process. Up front, make it very clear to the developers the different stages of applications that you're going to have to submit. For example, the smart code, let's say you're doing a greenfield T&D or retrofitting in an old mall or base that's gone, more of an infill type. Right? There's three phases. There's the for a greenfield, there's Article 3 phase, Article 5A, and Article 5B. We're not going to get into the details of all those, but those are the three phases. Well, we had to define, okay, for each of those phases, what parts of the smart code you had to comply with. Okay, the developers needed that. And we defined it very specifically saying, and we gave them checklists and other things like that. I'll tell you about another tool we've created. It's a computer-based one in just a little bit. But we've created these checklists where they could say, okay, this is what I have to do for an Article 3. And so what they do, then they go give it to David, or they go give it to Mike, or whoever, and they say, okay, you're my town planner, my designer for this project. Create the submission. Okay, and having those tools in place created this predictability. They knew that if they got Article 3 approved, they could do certain things. They could, you know, they'd be confident in hiring their engineers to cut the roads and do some other things. Then they knew that Article 5A, if that was approved, they could get a certain thing, in this case, a building permit. And Article 5B, if you get that approved, you get your CO. And so we had these benchmarks, and we put those in the code and made it very clear so there wasn't any of this, you know, oh, that's what the law says, but we have a tendency to negotiate this. Okay? And you just kind of submit to the planning office. That didn't happen here because we defined in the front end. And then we finally developed tools for the review process. Tools for the planning staff. Okay? These checklists, flow charts, all kinds of tools. I have several of them with me if you want to come see me afterwards. We didn't have 20 minutes of time to show you all these tools. One of the tools, a real interesting tool, as well as tools for the development community, is if you go out, and I can say this because I'm not part of Placemakers, I'm just a law professor, but I've helped them put together this smart code navigator software, which, everyone use TurboTax, something like that. It's just the application process. That was kind of my idea. It's just like, you know, TurboTax makes a lot of sense. Just that you ask the questions and then you answer and they click, 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 and you end up with the result. That's what we've done with the Smart Code Navigator software. Is okay. Here's for Article 3. You know, it asked you a question. Is this got 40 acres? Yes, no, and then it takes you to the next place. We found that computer-based is that was really helpful. People were so used to using TurboTax that someone in the planning office says, hey, could we have like the TurboTax for the smart code? We could just ask questions. We're like, brilliant idea. You know, Guinness commercial, brilliant. You know, that was, yeah. So we created that tool. So all these different tools, some written, some computer generated. The goal of all these tools is because people learn in different ways. There's one guy, one developer who wants the flow chart. Okay, show me on a flow chart, because he's used to flow charts. Okay, we created a flow chart about the post-adoption process. If you want to get a code permitted, this is what you do. This is the flow chart. One wanted the checklist. They're used to using, and so they check. One wanted to use it on the computer, so we used the computer. Okay, we created all these different tools. Ultimately, and I'll close with this, this was the goal. Ken Groves, a city planner in Montgomery, and Mayor Bright, who is incredibly helpful, their goal was to be thorough enough to be credible, yet flexible enough to be responsive. Let me explain what they meant by that. We want to be thorough. We want to regulate this thoroughly. Form-based codes, the smart codes, transect-based codes, generally regulate. There's more stuff being regulated than just your typical Euclidean code. Now, that's not more than being regulated totally, because what the smart code does, it brings in your landscape ordinance, your tree ordinance, your sign ordinance, your subregs, your zoning, all these parts which should be interacting, it brings them all together into a single code. It's one-stop coding. Okay? So it's thorough. It's thorough enough, and by being thorough, even though it's a little, it can be at your first run or two through, can be a little bit more daunting because they're like all these regulations in one place look a lot bigger than a bunch of regulations in different places. It's thorough enough, it gains credibility because you're like, okay, if I can master this, I don't have to master five other ordinances. If I can master this smart code, I know that all of the codes, except for in this case the historic preservation code, everything is governed in this single code. We couldn't quite get that politically done. But flexible enough to be responsive. The smart code, a real interesting tool, is they have a variance process. You can go through the public hearing, but they also have administrative warrants where the planning department is given some discretion to make decisions which are small deviations which still comply with the purpose section. For example, Hampstead. They needed a warrant, a warranted deviation from the code. Why? Well, the code says, for, let's say, T4 maximum block size of, I don't remember off the top of my head, 2,000 feet or whatever. Well, they had a block which was 2,050 feet. Okay, what is that? Well, I mean, less than one-tenth of a deviation. But it was a deviation. It was technically not permitted. Well, why did they have an extra 50 feet? It was because there was this prominent oak tree, okay, that they kind of jagged around because they wanted to keep it. Okay, they wanted to keep that on the block, and there was some, again, Mike worked on the project, but you could ask George or Galena or somebody. I mean, it was very sound design reason why they did that. Okay. Well, do you think, even as good a developer as Ann and Harvey are in Colonial, do you think that if they would have to go through the public notice hearing 30, 60-day process to save an oak tree, you think they would have saved the tree? No way. But if they can have the planning staff say, yeah, this is a very minor deviation. It makes a lot of sense why you're doing this minor deviation. We have the discretion, the authority to grant this. Because if you take that authority away from them, down goes the tree, because no developer is going to hold up their project 60 days, I can't imagine, to save a tree. Now, obviously, that's a point of potential abuse. So you have to create operating guidelines. Okay, what is minor? You have to define things like minor. And so the discretion you can't leave completely unfettered, because then you start getting back into the negotiation process and it can be a point of abuse. But it's thorough enough to be credible, yet flexible enough to be responsive. The real world is not in a flat grid on a flat piece of land, although that's much of Montgomery. Okay? The real world has unique challenges, and your code has to be flexible enough to respond to those. And that's what the goal was. Step one of the Montgomery downtown is the very first thing that happened, the restoration of the plaza in Montgomery Round. You can see down Dexter. This is step one, and we hope we creep back, use this code to allow it to creep back and create new things. Closing advice from someone. I mean, I couldn't. I hang around these guys long enough. I know what galleries are and stuff like this. I've kind of picked up on the lingo, but I still couldn't design one if I had to save my life, or at least one that wouldn't cave in. But I'm the guy who afterwards, after they do these plans, say, okay, now we got to get this approved. Okay, we got to get so it's legal to do. So that, you know, that arcade or that gallery you want to build that's going to encroach in the public right away, we got to figure out how legally to put that into the ground. It's in the airway of the public right away, and it's also going to be fixed into the public right away. There's a variety of other things. From that perspective, form-based codes, transit-based codes, smart code, all of these above, are not glamorous. It's hard work. It's a lot easier to get projects permitted under Euclidean code, based on my experience. Okay? It's also a lot easier never to run the marathon. It's also a lot easier to never to learn how to play the guitar. It's a lot easier to never master the second language. It can be a challenge, folks. I don't want to sell you a bill of goods. It can be a really hard challenge. So if you're committed to meeting that challenge, if your community is committed to meeting that challenge, the results will be amazing. Okay? But the work to get those results is going to be a challenge. So, I'm sure we'll have time for questions afterwards, but thank you for your time.